Welcome to the Cloud Pod, where the forecast is always cloudy. We talk weekly about all things AWS, GCP, and Azure. We are your hosts,
Justin,
Jonathan,
Ryan,
and Matthew.
Episode 254, recorded for the week of April 3rd, 2024. The Cloud Pod offers therapy sessions to AIs with trust issues. Good evening, Ryan, Matt, and Jonathan. How's it going?
Good. Hey, guys.
Good.
The most important thing is this is the show before Google Next.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. So we just did this not that long ago. And because they decided to move to Vegas and get new dates, we got to do it again within 6 months. So that made predictions that much more complicated. So it was, we'll get to that a little later. But yes, Google Next is next week. I will be there. Ryan will be there as well. And Jonathan and Matt will be wishing they were, well, actually, no, they'll be happy they aren't with us, I'm sure, is how it's going to work out.
Mm-hmm. Kind of happy about that.
They won't be wishing they're with us. So, but Matt and Jonathan will be home, but Ryan and I will be there. I will bring stickers. If you see us wandering on the floor, we will hopefully have them on us, or at least be able to tell you when we can meet up to give you them later. But we're excited to meet some of you, our avid listeners, and we will probably also tweet at some point, someplace we will be on maybe Wednesday evening before the concert, so you can catch up with us, or maybe Tuesday. We'll figure it out. Keep an eye on our CloudPod One Twitter account, as well as myself and Ryron01 to find out where we're at. If you'd like to get those sweet, sweet stickers. So
yeah, if anyone doesn't want to see pictures of me watching Next from my hot tub, subscribe to my Patreon.
Nice. All right. Well, let's get into the news. First up, we have follow-up from last week's placeholder KV, which it was very much a placeholder, as Amazon, Google, and Oracle all backed it with, along with the Linux Foundation, to make it Valky. So placeholder KV is now known as Valky. Ericsson and Snap also jumped on the Valky bandwagon, which was kind of interesting because we talked about last week Snap had their alternative branch fork already. But overall, glad to see Redis has ended up with Linux Foundation, backed by AWS, Google, and Oracle. So pretty happy there.
I'm wondering how long before Azure says, oops, we made a mistake.
Never. Azure doesn't make mistakes.
No, never. This. I'm never fully aware of that after the last couple of weeks.
Yeah. Of course, anytime an open source project goes closed source or SSPL to get rid of the hypervisor, someone has to blog or write an article about how, if the cloud providers just contributed back to the world, we wouldn't have to do these things. And of course, that article came to us this time from InfoWorld, which, basically said what I just said. All right. But then I looked into the author, Matt S.A. from InfoWorld, weighed in on this article. He says basically the fact that placeholder Valky was forked by several employees at AWS who were core contributors to Redis, doesn't matter to them. Although I think it does. I think it says very clearly that Amazon did care. They are contributing because they had hired Redis core contributors who were contributing to Redis core, who they then, forked it, and then Amazon supported them. So it seems like maybe Amazon was contributing in a way to Redis. I mean, I don't know what the exact pull requests look like, but the fact that they're actually paying salaries for people who are core contributors who were passionate enough to fork it does tell me that they're probably doing more than nothing. And then, of course, I found out Matt S.A. happens to run developer relations at MongoDB, and I realized this is a bit of a pot calling the kettle black.
Ah, that's hilarious. Yeah. It's funny because I always feel like the cloud contribution to these things is managed services around them, right? It's not necessarily improvements to the core source code. It's more management of that source code. Now, there are definitely areas where they do make enhancements, but I'm not sure the vast majority makes sense to be included in an open source made for everyone product either.
Yeah, well, and if you think that because you're building a managed service around an open source product that you should open source the managed service, I think that seems kind of disingenuous too. Mm-hmm. if you're making changes to Redis to support your managed service, I think those should get contributed back. Mm-hmm. Because again, you're making key changes to the product, but very, very interesting.
Did Redis have their own cloud like MongoDB did? Does?
I don't think they have their own cloud.
And so that's where I'm like, there's no real competition. They're taking your product and getting more user base to get more feedback and contributing. So I just feel like I'm missing something here of why
Oh, everyone. Yes, they do have their own cloud.
Oh, well, there you go. So, yes, they're a competitor too.
Yeah. They have a Redis Essentials, which costs you $5 a month. Redis Pro, which is 88 cents per hour, or an annual where you can negotiate your own special pricing. And they give you a 5.9 SLA on the Redis Pro at 88 cents. So, yeah.
Of all the managed services, I'd be surprised that anyone would want to host Redis somewhere that wasn't very, very local. I mean, the advantage of Redis is its speed. So, you know, putting it in a data center on the other side of the country doesn't seem like it's sort of in line with the needs.
I mean, private links, you can get them to host in every single region, every single cloud provider. A private link to it should be no different than being inside your same subscription account, whatever project. So if they did that, it wouldn't be bad. But yeah, if you're running east to west coast of the US, or, you know, you're trying to run in Australia and you're in the US, obviously, yes, that will break it down.
I don't know. I've always just abused Redis and treated it like a database instead of a cache. So I don't think I have to target out for any of this.
It also can be a queue.
All right. Well, an interesting event happened. The open source community was a bit shocked when a Microsoft developer revealed a backdoor that had been intentionally planted in the XZutils, which is an open source data compression utility available on almost all installations of Linux and other Unix-like operating systems. The person or people behind this project likely spent years working on it, and they were very close to seeing the backdoor merge into Core, Debian, and Red Hat when a software developer spotted a performance issue. XZutils, like I mentioned, is a lossless data compression that's used in virtually all Unix operating systems and is critical in all things like SSH and handling your SSH compression capabilities. It also supports the legacy LZMA format, making it even more critical to many. The developer found it worked at Microsoft and was working on the Microsoft Postgres offering and was troubleshooting performance issues with a Debian system and SSH. Specifically, SSH logins were consuming too many CPU cycles and were generating errors with Valgrind, a utility for monitoring computer memory. Malicious code added to the system modified the way the software functions when performing operations related to LZMA compression or decompression operation. And when these functions invoked in SSH, they allowed for malicious code to be executed with root privileges. This was a long con, though, as we mentioned. In 2021, the first time a change was made by the particular user, changing the libarchive project, replacing a safe underscore fprint function with a variant that was less secure, but no one noticed. The same user submitted a additional patch over the mailing list, and almost immediately, a never-before-seen participant named Jigar Kumar joined the discussion and argued that Lasse Collin, the longtime maintainer of XZutils, hadn't been updating the software often or fast enough, and Kumar, with the support of Dennis Enns and several other people who had never had a presence before, pressured Collin to bring on an additional developer to maintain the project. And that developer happens to be the same person who contributed the earlier code in 2021. In January 2023, GT75 is the name of the user, made their first commit to XZutils. In the months following, he became increasingly involved. And for instance, he replaced Collin's contact information with their own OSS-Fuzz, which is a project that scans open source software vulnerabilities that can be exploited. Tan also requested that the OSS-Fuzz disable the iFunk function during testing, a change that prevented from detecting the malicious changes Tan would soon make to XZutils. In February of this year, Tan issued commits to version 5.6 and 5.61. of XZutils. Updates implemented the backdoor, and in the following weeks, they appealed to developers of Ubuntu, Red Hat, and Debian to merge the updates into their OS. Eventually, one of the two updates made it into several releases, including Fedora Rawhide, Fedora 41, Debian testing, OpenSUSE Tumbleweed, and OpenSUSE MicroOS, and Kali Linux. The attack was clearly targeted at Debian and Red Hat distributions, as the attack only did the final steps of the backdoor when building the library on AMD 64 processors and were building a Debian or RPM package. Quite devious, indeed.
Typical Microsoft engineer finding every reason but their own product to to blame for latency.
I did not see that this is where this conversation was going to go. Yeah. I'm just saying.
No, that's awesome though. That's that kind of attention to details. Amazing. This could have been disastrous. This is a huge save.
Yeah, it would have been bad if it actually made it into Debian and Red Hat for sure.
I mean, I'm more curious of how many other small little projects like this. There are linchpins to so many things that, you know, one, two developers maintain that can open up so many backdoors and everything that we all operate.
Yeah, I think it kind of speaks to separations of concerns. You know, developers shouldn't be the people setting policies on things like security scanning configurations. If that had been, if those had been separate teams of people, then it would have been much harder to have made that change.
It's a two-person development team.
Yeah, it's a two-person development team. So, and the other thing that if you read through, you know, if you go into the articles and you read through the change and the commit history and this whole argument that happened about Lasse Collins not taking change requests fast enough, you know, he talks about, you know, he had been really busy and had been dealing with some mental issues and hadn't been as active as he'd like to be. And so he was looking to bring on a second developer. He'd already been working with GIT75 off mailing list on some things already, and so he had built trust with this person over time. And you know, it's a situation where, again, it's one guy who really built it and has been maintaining it for all this time, and then someone comes in and offers to help, and you're kind of just blessed with the help, especially if you're going through other things in your life that are difficult. And you know, it's a testament to the fact that open source works in this case, that this was detected because of open source. I don't know that this would have happened in a, you know, Microsoft probably has developers who maintain weird parts of the kernel that are only two people, and something very similar could happen too. You know, it's just, it's a risk that you take. And, you know, I agree there's separation you want to have here, but, you know, if you have a project that you love in open source, that's, you know, just a couple people who really maintain it, throw them some money. Like, seriously, like, you know, they typically have tip jars and they have different ways you can do it. Even the OpenSSH, you know, how big that deal was when that got compromised. You know, these things can happen, and we need to care for our open source friends.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think if major distributions are relying on these libraries, then they should assist with putting sort of governance controls in place to help this not happen again in the future. You know, if so, it's a two-man development team, great, but please use our framework to ensure that it's safe and secure.
Well, whose framework? Do you use Ubuntu's? Do you use Debian's? Do you use Fedora's? Like, where do you go with this? And then, or is there a centralized one? And ideally, you know, potentially there's, hey, start with this template that all the providers use, but backdating all that to open source projects that have been around for 10, 15, whatever sum of years, is its own level of complexity that if you're a one-person shop or even a five-person shop that does it part-time for fun on the weekends, you don't have that time to do the busy work.
It's funny, you mentioned the comment about a typical Microsoft engineer always, you know, always blaming somebody else for their performance problems. I think someone else was like, I'm more impressed that they tested performance. So definitely, you know, pleased to see Microsoft. It was a little bit of a surprise that they are the good party in this particular story.
So you think we'll see, you know, new security test suites where we're benchmarking SSH connections for here on out?
Like, maybe, I don't know.
I'm more also think that it's a testament to how well Git works, and you're able to backtrack all of that information that far. You know, like, everyone loves Git and loves the Git history, but like, because of the way Git is built and the way it's designed, we're able to go back in projects extremely far and see every little piece that a single person touched.
I mean, yeah, but usually it's just when I'm going through Git blame, turns out it's me at fault. So,
yeah. I was just saying, mine's normally swear words at myself.
This is like the first use case.
I'm gonna say, like, I can see myself introducing a bug like this mostly because I'm a bad developer, not because I was being malicious.
Yeah,
like, I don't know how to make that other thing work. I'm just gonna change this out to this, like, oh, you made it less secure.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry.
Curses. Yeah. Which I do all the time.
Yeah.
Like, I've already got a function for this. It uses this other thing. Yeah.
Exactly. All right. Well, thanks to the EU, you know, we've gotten a lot of really nice gifts lately. If you're in the EU, you can use alternative app stores on Apple devices here soon because of DMA. That then led to Apple getting sued in the US as well. And, you know, Slack had made some pretty strong complaints to the EU about the inclusion of Teams in the Office 365 bundle. And so if you are one of the 12 companies in the world that don't have an Office 365 subscription, you can now get one that does not include Teams, and basically pay for Teams separately if you're in the EU or in the overall globe. So basically, you can get a Office 365 subscription with or without Teams. If you'd like to add Teams, it costs you $5.65 per user per month. And while I suppose this is supposed to make it more competitive with Slack, my quick math on this was that Zoom is $15 per user per month, and Slack is $7.25 a user per month. So I'm going to spend $22.25 to get both of those products versus pay $5.65 from already in the Microsoft ecosystem. So yeah, I don't know if it's really going to help competition, but yeah, it's still something that's improving because of the EU. So thanks, EU.
I'm pretty sure Slack will still complain that $5.65 is still an unfair price for the product, though.
I mean, they could complain about that too.
Yeah.
I mean, I wonder if the one good thing I can say about Teams, and there is one at least, is that, you know, it's integration across the, you know, Office 365 products is nice, right? There's, you get documents that are available in both or multiple different applications, and I can manage calendar invites, and I can do that, and I only have to do that with one app and that sort of thing. Like, I wonder if like moves like this are going to actually like halt sort of innovation in that area, where it's like, if you can only innovate these things and integrate them to so far before, you know, someone's going to be like, that's anti-competitive. So that's sort of interesting to me.
I mean, I the $5.65 per user per month sort of makes sense because they just built it on top of SharePoint. So, you know, this doesn't include your SharePoint costs. It's just the Teams part of it, which is all built on top of SharePoint.
So. I didn't realize until like six to eight months into using it, of how tightly coupled SharePoint and Teams were, and like how tightly coupled they were together. And even like you create certain things and it has to have a SharePoint site on the back end, and it's like, I just don't understand why it's so tightly coupled.
Yeah. I think that's actually one of the problems with Teams is because of that exact reason. Is they did heavily embed it with SharePoint. So they basically attach it to a boat anchor, which is SharePoint. And it explains a lot of its weird idiosyncrasies about how it thinks about Teams because it's all based on SharePoint acumen and permission models. So I am sure the SharePoint admins who had to maintain the database are not happy about it either, because I'm sure it made the database even worse than it already was, because the SharePoint database is horrible.
I just want somebody to tell me how I make a group that's not a team, so it doesn't have everything have to be threaded, that's not a group chat with like a DM thread with that's renamed. I want Slack's group concept in Teams. That's all I want.
That's a chat by any other name, right? The difference is the browsing and discovery of it, right? Which you can't do natively in Teams, but
right, that's
you,
what I
you
want.
You can start a chat. Yeah, okay. Yeah. I mean, it is, I'm just happy that you can target them for, you know, API level stuff as identities now, where you couldn't for a long time. Yeah. Yeah. Individual chats you can, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. You'll have to send me those APIs.
And but I still can't use them because I can't authenticate into Teams to save my life. Because I think
that's a different problem.
But I would much rather have Slack and Zoom, but there's no part of me that would pay as much money per user in a large org.
For Slack or for Teams?
For Zoom and Slack, like you start $22 a user for if you're.
I mean, that's list pricing off their website. I imagine you get up into larger volumes, you get better volume discounts. But I don't. It would be a hard argument if you're not already on Google Apps and Google Workspaces to, not go with Microsoft if you're an Office shop. Mm-hmm. I think that's part of Slack's argument, is that, you know, it's too easy for customers to adopt this thing that's anti-competitive. So.
I will still say I still like just Google Meet. I understand it's not the best out there, but like it worked. It worked pretty damn well.
I mean, Google Meet still exists.
You go with Chime too, so
yeah.
No, Chime doesn't work well.
And Meets doesn't really work well either, because it requires you to be in a browser, because they keep killing all the desktop clients. So I don't know.
Well, I guess they never have a problem with it in a browser.
I struggle with email in a browser sometimes. So Meets was one of those things that I always missed reminders of. Because it wasn't in my face.
Oh, no. See, I had Slack, which notified me of the Google Meet 1 minute before it was going to start.
Oh, yeah. If you have that set up.
That was my setup.
Yeah.
I actually wish they didn't integrate email with the Teams app on the phone now, because you've got Teams, the Teams chats. We've got the regular chats. We've got my calendars on there. Like, just give me my email in the same app. Like, it's just...
I mean, that'd be
so
nice.
Close.
I mean, they added in calendar updates to the activity feed inside of Teams client this week, and I about murdered people because every time someone accepted a meeting, it would pop up as an activity indicator, and I had to go figure out how to turn that off. I was like, this has to die because I can't.
What's weird is you and I had different experiences. Like the features rollout still impact me, but the only thing that I got a notification for in Teams was when I got invited to a new meeting. I'm wondering what the differences were between our settings. Because I do tailor my settings a lot to like basically make any chat thing stop making noise and distraction.
Yeah, I know, that's why we can never reach you.
It's true. The alternative, though, is that I'm always like...
You're overstimulated by shiny alerts. Yeah. My wife has the same problem. So she turns off all the alerts on her phone where I have like all mine on. So she uses my phone. She's like, how do you do with this? And I'm like, I just ignore them. She's like, yeah. I can't. It's stressing me out.
It does. It gives me anxiety.
Yeah. No. So like the unread, the little, indicators on an icon, that'll get me because I'm like an inbox zero kind of guy. So like, I don't want to see any indicators that have unread things, but I don't mind the notification coming in if it just pops up and goes away. I know it's happening, but if it leaves a number behind or a red dot, it'll die.
Yeah.
I'll kill that every time. Which is basically what the problem with activity feed is it's just a red dot.
Yeah.
I run our tech all hands, and I'm just imagining adjusting the date and getting, because I don't think I have that yet, and getting like 70 notifications of people accepting, declining, and everything like that. I might kill someone.
Yeah.
I might be in Ryan's boat on this.
I do think on this particular computer where it updated to that, although I think it was my work one too, I think I am on the early adopter channel, not the beta event channel, but the early adopter channel. So I might have gotten what you're about to get later, Ryan. Good luck to you.
Bye, Ryan. We'll see you in a month.
Let us know when that happens.
I'm going to turn that off.
You can turn it off proactively, sure. All right. Cohere embeddings are now available through Elastic's Inference API. For those of you who are still foolishly thinking that Elasticsearch is your AI play, it is not. You can now use Cohere's embed V3 models in Elastic's Inference API. This allows your business to create embeddings for their data easily, index those embeddings in Elastic, and perform vector and hybrid searches across their documents. Developers can use Elastic's ingest pipelines to add Cohere embeddings to their indices for vector search with a single API call, and they can take advantage of Cohere's native embedding compression to reduce storage costs by 75%. And if you're doing this, again, don't recommend it.
To be honest, AI is the only way that you're going to solve Elasticsearch ingest problem. True. So, like, I'm kind of for this, like, because that's what it would take. Like, if you're trying to use Elasticsearch as and not being in complete control of the data input.
See, I think this is all about them trying to use Elastic as a source for the training models, and so I think you have a different problem, which is trying to scale your shards to not be able to support the ML training models hitting your indexes. So I think you have a different problem. I don't think it's trying to solve the ingest problem as much yet.
I think a lot of it equals the same thing, though, because a lot of the problem with the ingest really is still at the shard level and managing the shards and finding the hotspots that you get because this index doesn't have enough shards associated with it and how to roll that index over. And so like a lot of the problems coexist. It does, it's not going to manage your data enrichment like your ingest pipeline, that kind of thing. But it should. It should just do what I want all the time with AI.
Nice. Well, Databricks apparently needed a stock bump. And so they're announcing DBRX, their new open source large language model built by the Mosaic research team that outperforms all established open source models on standard benchmarks. They have three reasons for you to be excited about DBRX. It handily beats open source models such as Llama 2-70B, Mixtral, and Grok 1 on language understanding, programming, math, and logic. It beat GPT-3.5 on most benchmarks, which is important as they have seen a major behavioral shift in the last quarter among their 12,000 customers. Enterprises and organizations are increasingly replacing proprietary models with OSS models for better efficiency and control. And DBRX is a mixture of experts model built on the MegaBlocks research and open source project, making the model extremely fast in terms of tokens per second.
It's pretty cool. I just wish I had the hardware to run it. It's great being open source, but unless you've got massive GPUs or tons of RAM to do inference in with a regular CPU, you're kind of out of luck. But no, I'm very keen on trying it. The mix of experts sort of technique is really interesting.
Do they have a cloud you can just host DBRX in, or is it purely on your own hardware? So I would imagine, you know, like most of these programmers, they'll provide a chatbot at some point that runs that you can play with. So.
I expect you could import it into either AWS or Google tools and run inference in there.
I'm mostly shocked that Amazon hasn't already announced their new partnership with Databricks to bring DBRX to Bedrock.
Next week.
Mm-hmm. That'll be the thing. Mm-hmm. I was shocked it wasn't a co-announcement. Speaking of Amazon, something's coming up in Philadelphia in June. That's June 10th through the 12th, the Reinforce, which I forgot was a thing completely. After going to the first one in Boston, I totally forgot that they do this. Some of the highlights from the event, I promise, we talks about how AWS secures AWS and Steve Schmidt's vision of the future, and I'm sure quite a bit of security in the generative AI era. So I'm going to watch that keynote from my hot tub, like Jonathan's going to watch Google next week, and not go to that. But I do look forward to seeing what Steve Schmidt has to share for his vision of the future. I wonder if it includes cloud. You think so? Maybe? I
don't know. No, yeah. Never.
Yeah, I keep waiting for them to host this and not like some sort of hellscape part of the country. You know, it's always in June, and like they had moved it to Houston. Yeah, and I'm not going to Texas in the middle of summer. Like I have a very limited operating range for temperatures. And now they're doing Philadelphia, and I'm like, I don't know what the weather's like in Philadelphia, except for what winter and it's cold. So when it comes to like somewhere near me or something like that, I'll give it another chance because I want this to be good. I want a security conference like this where you get direct access.
It's kind of sad that it wasn't in Baltimore and they couldn't tie into the container ship hitting the bridge. Like
I thought it was always sunny in Philadelphia.
So we're sad about it. They were so close. They were so close, just a few states away. Amazon GuardDuty EC2 runtime monitoring is now generally available. The release expands the threat detection coverage for EC2 instances at runtime and complements the anomaly detection that GuardDuty already provides with continuously monitoring VPC flow logs, DNS query logs, and AWS CloudTrail management events. You now have visibility into on-host, OS-level activities, and container-level context into detected threats. GuardDuty EC2 runtime allows you to identify and respond to threats that might target compute resources, and these may include remote code executions that lead to the download and execution of malware on your box. Or just upgrading to the latest version of XV utils.
Yeah. I mean, it's slowly becoming an anti-malware, you know, tool and going to replace some of these other tools that everyone has. It's, you know, one less agent that you need on these boxes, consuming more CPU, more memory, more everything. So, you know, it's nice to see that they're slowly expanding, but at what point does Amazon get yelled out that AWS is taking over too many markets like Microsoft did with Teams?
Yeah, this is very
there's a FTC lawsuit against Amazon, so it's coming.
Yeah. It's coming.
Yeah. Yeah, I think what this agent does is very similar to what CrowdStrike does.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting, though, because CrowdStrike, you know, is a pretty big vendor to Amazon. They've been good partners for a long time. So it's sort of interesting how Amazon's basically, you know, stabbing their partner in the back at the same time.
I mean, that's what they do, though.
Yeah, so yeah. They bring out a new feature that a partner needed to deploy products, and then 2 years you get 2 years runtime, and after that, They'll eat your lunch.
Amazon is renaming AWS CodeStar Connections to AWS Code Connections. The name change is effective everywhere, including the API, CLI, and Web Console. And all I want to say is just note this, because this feels like something coming for reInvent. Something's coming. That's my feeling. Because you don't just rename this thing for no reason. Getting rid of CodeStar is an interesting choice.
Code Connections. Code Connections. That sounds like a dating app for mobile apps. I don't know.
I mean, I remember being really annoyed when CodeStar was on the DevOps proficiency exam, because literally no one used that service or talked about that service. And there's not really a whole lot to it other than like, hey, are you DevOps? You're DevOps too. We like DevOps. And that wasn't really...
I feel like CodeStar wasn't talked about that much, but they did use all the code.
The code family. Code commit, code deploy, code build.
Right. Yeah, mm-hmm. I was trying to be more general. Like, I don't think I remember ever seeing a CodeStar question, but...
Oh, there was one on my test.
Mm. You were probably in the behavior pin.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, interesting enough, I just went to CodeStar because I didn't even remember what it did. And there's a note here. It says, on July 31st, 2024, Amazon Web Services will discontinue support for creating and viewing CodeStar projects. after July 31st, you will no longer be able to access the AWS CodeStar console or create new projects. Did they deprecate something? Oh my God, Amazon.
Amazing. Really?
Good job.
At least for,
I mean, they did deprecate Honeycode, to be fair.
Yeah, so. But Honeycode was never part of Amazon, the console.
I know.
But yeah, no, that's interesting. So it was always sort of a weird product. Just even reading the features now, I was like, oh yeah, project templates. It's like a backstage competitor, but worse.
But that's what it was. It was just an easy front door into all the other Amazon families.
Well, maybe they're something better. Code
families.
I'm okay with embracing Amazon Backstage. Like, bring me Backstage Managed Service, please. That'd be great. Take it. All right. Amazon DynamoDB imports now allows you to import 50,000 S3 objects in a single bulk import to Dynamo. I didn't know I wanted to do this, but I'm sure it's somehow AI or ML related. And it kind of feels like an ETL, so I guess it's better than an ETL. So I'm here for the nonsense.
Why would I want to do this?
DR, that's all I got for you.
DR, yeah, perhaps, maybe.
Like, I don't need to, if multi-region DynamoDB is too complicated and you back up all your blobs to all your data to S3 and a multi-region, you know, replicated bucket, then you could just tell it to re-import all your data. It's my biggest stretch I've got for you guys.
Yeah,
that's a stretch. Well, if someone knows what you would want to do this for, please let us know. Email us at the cloud pod.
I honestly think it's more about data migration between different services, data lakes, things like that.
That can make sense too. But thinking of all things you can do with an S3 bucket, you could, you know, use it to import logs into Dynamo and then do other ML things on it. You could do other terrible, horrible practices. You can make S3 basically be a dumb database that then you want to actually do SQL things, you put into Dynamo for some weird reason. Like, lots of different scenarios, I suppose.
Do you know what's more old school than blowing on a Nintendo cartridge to make it work? Manually creating individual policies to achieve least privilege in your cloud. Leave old habits in the past, and with a single click, lock down access to sensitive permissions and services without disrupting DevOps. With the new Cloud Permissions Firewall from Sunry Security, you can easily restrict excessive permissions from human and machine identities, quarantine unused identities, and restrict specific regions and unused services with a click of a button. Start a 14-day free trial for Sunry's Cloud Permissions Firewall at sunry.co/cloudpod. That's sonrai.co/cloudpod.
AWS is now allowing customers to enable cost allocation tags retroactively for up to 12 months. As long as customers have added tags to a specific resource in the past, customers can activate or deactivate cost allocation tags today and apply cost allocation tags to historical usage for these resources for up to 12 months. Which, if it was just I can now apply cost allocation tags to resources and then be able to view them or regenerate my cur file, this would be really cool. But this limitation of, like, you had to have once tagged it before means you just, all you can do now is tag it differently and it'll map that appropriately. So it, on the surface, looks really awesome, but the devil's in the details on this one.
Mm.
So is it a typo? Because everything is case sensitive and definitely all of our developers always type, you know, their cost allocation department correctly, that, you know, that you can just change that?
Yeah, I guess that's a good use case for it. Like, yeah, you know, because Ryan put a capital and Jonathan used camel case and you used all capitals. Yeah, yeah, you can solve that problem in the dashboard versus solving it in the data set.
Yeah. And you have to email them to request it, huh?
Yeah, you have to email them to request access. So
close. Yeah, that part I don't.
Yeah. Again, like, maybe this is the beginning of something more cool coming later, because there's a lot of really great things they could be doing in cost management, but they're just not yet. So maybe in the future we'll see something else here.
Yeah, how cool would it be? Like, the feature we all wanted, we read this, right, was that you tag something and then historically all the usage back in time is now accessible or dimensioned by that tag, right? Like, that's what we want.
Yep. That would be
I also ideal. Want a unicorn and a pony.
Hey, no, don't get too crazy. Yeah.
That's the GCP prediction part of the show.
Yeah. Right.
All right. Well, this week I found something on Twitter that I had to share. So someone posted about EC2.shop. EC2.shop is a simple web interface that you can curl to from the command line. So if you do curl and then https://EC2.shop and you hit return, you get a list of all of the instances and their price on a monthly or spot price basis and their hourly price. You can then filter that down by region. You can filter it to specific instance types, Windows, Linux, etc. You can also output it as JSON. And so instead of using the dumb API from Amazon that's complicated, I can just use curl now to solve all my scripting problems. So this is pretty cool. I really like this. And hey, if someone wants to build these for GCP and Azure, I wouldn't mind.
Yeah, no kidding. Like, this is fantastic. Even when you use it on the browser, like, it's pretty sweet. It's a rudimentary UI, but which is fine, right? Because I really want to curl it. But the fact that you can, you know, query your search and be able to quickly get multiple different instance types in multiple regions and multiple different configurations, pretty awesome.
Wow. The most expensive hourly price, $218.40.
What is it?
U-24TB1, 112x large. That's insane. What is that thing?
I remember when they launched the X1s, and I kept threatening Ryan I was going to sneak in my code, an X1 that would get launched.
Threatening? You did it, and I didn't catch it, right?
Nope. But I never actually launched
it. You didn't put it to production, but it did get past my code review, so it got me.
2.5 terabytes of RAM, 448 vCPUs.
Wow.
So I can run one Microsoft SQL database.
Yep. One SAP HANA node.
Yeah. That's nuts. Oof. I wonder, like, if you have that use case, or that's like mainframe size, right? Like, you're getting into, like, you got some sort of weird use case.
I mean, for $218 an hour, 448 vCPUs is actually... It's not a bad price.
How many GPUs does it have? Can you run your Databricks LLM there, yeah. Jonathan?
Doesn't say if it's got any GPUs attached.
I mean, it's only like 1660K a month. No big deal.
Pocket change.
What's $288 per hour between friends?
Maybe that's the next trend in cloud computing. Like, you know, after repatriation back to the data centers, what we'll see now with the remaining cloud customers is instead of scaling horizontally, they'll just go to these mega machines and host every single process on one server.
Oh, I totally lied. It's not 2.5 terabytes. It's 24 terabytes of RAM.
Oh.
Oh, off of zero.
Off of zero.
I still remember when like 1 gigabyte of RAM was like ridiculous.
I remember those days too. Like, I've had that conversation with a developer a couple times now. Like, well, you know, this T3 micro server is smaller than my laptop. I'm like, yeah, your laptop, I don't pay by the hour. So screw you. You're still using it.
Yeah.
For those of you who like Chef, you probably are very familiar with OpsWorks and your ability to run Chef code or Puppet code. For those of you who like that type of thing. And then for those of you who were like, OpsWorks too complicated, you could then run, of course, Chef code inside of SSM with the Run Chef toolkit. And I always assumed that worked on Windows and Linux. But this announcement tells me otherwise, that now it supports Windows, which it did not support previously. And so now you can run Chef 11 through 18 recipes on either EC2 or on-premise instances managed by AWS Systems Manager. These capabilities were previously only available to Linux, but now available to you on the Windows side too. And so God rest your soul if you're doing this.
I mean, Chef is probably the only configuration management tool that I think is like actually works on Windows. So like I'll give them that. Like, and you're right, I made the assumption that Systems Manager worked on both, and I don't have enough Windows workloads that I ever tested that theory. So
be happy with that statement.
Yeah, I am. Well, I mean, yeah, it's also in days past.
And in a name that I will never remember again after this podcast, AWS Deadline Cloud is now a new fully managed service that enables creative teams to easily set up render farms in minutes, scale to run more projects in parallel, and only pay for what you use. AWS Deadline Cloud provides a web-based portal with the ability to create and manage render farms, preview and progress renders, view and analyze renderer logs, and easily track the costs of your render. Originally, I thought this is a very small market of Pixar and DreamWorks, but apparently it's also used in architecture, engineering, and construction companies, as well as media and entertainment companies. You have the flexibility to bring your own licenses or leverage third-party renderers such as Maya, Nuke, or Houdini.
Huh. What a... Like, I feel like they had this name, they're like, this is good, and they had to apply it to something.
Well, I wonder if it was like Pixar or somebody else came to them and was like, hey, you know, we have this issue where we really need to be able to manage the render farm. We need to be able to do more parallelization. And they're like, well, why would you need to do more parallelization? I'm like, well, you know, because we're on a deadline to get the build out, you know, to get it shipped the movie. And they're like, oh, okay, we'll create you a deadline cloud service. Like, that was that. I feel like that was the conversation, but I don't really know.
It's like batch for EC2 in a way. I think it's all about building pipelines and things and jobs, and then Deadline Cloud manages the underlying EC2 resources for you. So it's kind of like a batch tool, I guess.
Yeah, I have to admit I know nothing about rendering and why you'd need a farm or what it's used for. Like,
so I know that like way back in the day I worked for a healthcare company that did 3D imaging of teeth. And they would use Blender, which is a different tool like Maya, to kind of even like do for like molding. So you were able to kind of visualize the tooth. So like there's actually a lot of different industries that use this type of stuff besides just, you know, what we all think of like movies. You know, think even like rendering like your house or a neighborhood or anything like that. Like if you're, you know, building a standard community where like every house is the same or anything like that. People always like to see things versus like see a two-dimensional.
So I guess these rendering farms are processing like a 3D scan or something like that, right?
Yeah, in general.
It's,
yeah.
The data has to exist and then it's just rendered out into a model that you can manipulate.
Yeah.
All right, let's move to Google, the main event tonight.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. First of all, let's talk about the one announcement they had. First up, this week they announced Google Cloud Backup and DR has been upgraded to make VM protection even easier. Google is announcing a new feature for Google Cloud Backup and DR, making it easier to safeguard your critical Google VMs. You can leverage the power of Google Cloud Tags, including inheritance, to easily configure backup policies for Compute Engine VMs, ensuring consistent protection for your dynamic cloud environments. And this is also one of those things that I don't think I realized this limitation previously, but you can now backup the VM state to your DR site using Google Cloud Backup.
You know, I kind of thought the same thing. And as I was thinking about it, like AWS backup for a long time just backed up like snapshots of the volumes and never the actual host.
Yep.
And I feel, and then like later on, they like went to like the full AMAs, and that's kind of what this is. So I feel like this is that same natural progression that like Amazon did. So I guess it kind of makes sense. But again, I didn't realize it wasn't built in already.
Yeah, I mean, you back up the whole machine and try and bring it up another region, but it comes up with the wrong network interface and the wrong IP address and a whole bunch of connectivity issues. I don't know. I think it's if you're relying on this for your backup strategy, it's could be better.
Yeah. All right. So Google Next is next week in beautiful Las Vegas at the Mandalay Bay Hotel and Casino and Exposition Hall in the back. I would normally give you like a bunch of tips and tricks about how to survive a conference in Vegas, typically based on my experience with reInvent. However, this is only one hotel. So while I still agree on good shoes and all those sort of things, you know, do those things, be hydrated, don't drink too much, which I won't follow that one, but
yeah, I was going to say what?
I'm trying to be good for our listeners. So the nice thing is Google has dropped a ton of articles about, different sessions that you might want to attend based on your persona. So there's one for security, one for data professionals, one for developers, networking people, and well as cloud architects they've released so far. There may even be more that get released later on this week, but we're recording on an end of day Tuesday, and you know, there's still three more days before we even head out to Vegas. So if this wasn't one of your personas, do check it out, as I'm sure they have published something for you as well. As always, for these big shows, we do predictions, unless for Microsoft, because Microsoft shows are stupid. And so it's really just Google and Amazon that we do this for, and so we have attempted
make us do one this year.
Okay, Matt.
Make us do one.
All right, Matt. We'll talk about it. You got to tell me the dates. I don't even know when it's happening. But anyway, so the prediction show is based on non NDA information that we have about Google Cloud. If we had any NDA information, which they don't ever share with us because they don't share anything about their roadmap. So we're going to really be guessing about what they potentially will announce. We did roll dice before the show recording today. And I got the first slot, followed by Jonathan, followed by Matt, and finally up with Ryan. So we will go through this draft style, pick out what we think is going to be announced, and hope we get a point. And we'll talk about it after Google Next and see who won our prediction show. So since I am first on the board, I'm going to take my first pick, and I'm going to take the easiest one I could come up with, which is they're going to announce Gemini 2.0 will ship at Google Next.
It's kind of soon.
Awfully quick after yeah.
Well, 1.5 was such a disaster. They're just going to bump to 2 so they can get away from this, the stink of Gemini 1.5.
Yeah, that's reasonable.
All right, Jonathan, that puts you on the board.
It does, yeah. It's a feature I would like because it would help with the thing I'm building. I really, really want IAM conditions to support the ability to call a web service or, you know, a cloud function or something that I build so I can build some like custom inline logic into IAM policy evaluations.
That would be amazing. You're absolutely right.
There's so many limits. Only one policy per resource, only this many principles of a certain type per policy. And like it's and the 3,000 character length for things. Like there's so much that we could do with this kind of integration. I really want to see it.
I mean, yes, I do want to see this, but main stage in the main keynote, I doubt it.
No chance. No.
But I appreciate your optimism. So
yeah.
All right, Matt, that puts you on the board.
Just saying, I feel like I have some disadvantages here. But I'm going to go with healthcare is going to be on the main stage.
A healthcare company, a healthcare product. Healthcare
company. Company.
Healthcare company will be a guest on the main stage.
Yeah, just given all the healthcare like issues that have happened recently in the U.S. around, you know, like all the backlog, all the back-end healthcare processing and whatnot, I think, you know, Google is going to come out with something and bring somebody on to kind of talk about, you know, how they help the healthcare companies and kind of go around that path.
So this one was one of mine. So good thing I came up with 4 in the last minute. And it was AI integration into healthcare specifically. So,
I mean, they already have MetaLM, which they announced last Google Next. So that seems reasonable.
I forget what, I know they have a healthcare offering. I thought it was more data leaky than it was.
Yeah, I don't know much about MetaLM.
Generative.
So I don't really know. But.
Yeah.
All right. Healthcare company will be guest on main stage. I take it. Highlighting either the use of MetaLM or some other backend processing that Google specializes in. All right, Ryan, that puts you on the board. Mm-hmm.
GCP will highlight or demonstrate how they're using AI to tackle our climate crisis problems.
Tackle the climate crisis. Good. That's not a bad one.
There you go, Ryan. That was payback. That was my second one.
Nice. Around
Google. They were going to mention and see how they were fixing sustainability issues.
Yeah. I am going with a LLM/prompt security solution from Google/Mandiant for my number 2 pick. Jonathan, you're number 2.
I'm going to go a bit broader with this one. Still, I am. I'm going to cover my bases here.
They will not announce anything for IAM on main stage.
I think there will be announcements for IAM on main stage. I think there'll be some significant feature improvements announced for IAM.
I feel like you spent a lot of time in the IAM world recently.
I have.
So you're just going with like they're going to announce something for anything for IAM.
Please God, fix IAM.
This is the future I want, but fix the whole thing.
I think new IAM feature on main stage, even if it's not the one I want.
Okay.
I'd give you that one just because I think it's so far-fetched that IAM is going to be on main stage. It
totally will be.
Yeah.
Totally will be. And my third one is somewhat related, but not quite.
Well, you have to hold that one for now. Matt, your second choice.
I kind of want to know what his third one is. Is it like, you know, we got so broad and so narrow. So like, where's
spoiler,
the
spoiler? It's going to be IAM related.
I'm going to go a little bit specific. I think there's going to be specific integrations with, you know, Gemini and with BigQuery.
I mean, they have, they just announced 3 or 4 weeks ago the ability to do, what is it called when you connect the database to the LLM and it does live lookups? Just did that a little
RAG.
Well, it's part of RAG, but it's a specific, they have a specific word for the use for the database. Anyways, all right, integration of Gemini and BigQuery. I like it. Ryan, your second pick.
See, I've got a trolley one.
Yeah,
a funny one. And then something that is just a from my wish list, because sweet God.
Wish list.
Okay, so my wish list is boring as all get out, but it's something that, like, I just don't want to maintain a file system server ever myself. Like, I just don't understand why I would ever do that. And GCP doesn't have a managed solution, and I want one. So GCP will announce a somehow managed network file share thing where I get to easily do something with files.
Wait, GCP doesn't have...
For the use case where I can't use objects because it's not under my control.
They don't have like a EFS or, you know, file share, FSx, Azure nothing. Files, anything?
Nothing.
No. See, I had a different one I wish you had asked for, but right, I won't use it either. all right. You know, I have come to find out that they are really upset about the confusion between Enterprise, GKE, and Anthos. And so I think they're going to announce something to help fix the brand confusion of GKE Enterprise.
Okay.
That's very anti-Google to fix confusion about any of their products.
They just kill one of them. They just kill one of them.
That was my funny one. They were going to kill something on main stage.
Yeah. That would be hilarious.
All right, Jonathan, your third and final pick.
It is not IAM.
Nah.
He was tricking all of us.
I know.
This is where he's getting at the point, I'm just saying.
Yeah.
Quite possibly. A new security forensics tool.
With AI or without?
How does that, because that kind of conflicts with the mandate Google from Justin's.
Well, mine is specifically around prompts and something with security, but he's talking about a security forensic solution that would help you do threat hunting and threat detection.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to speak many more words because everything I say is going to just narrow my scope. But I'm thinking, yeah. I mean, maybe it is based on manual technology. I don't know. I'm not going to commit to that. But I think it'll be.
I can just see a scenario where you both get a point separately, right? Like,
yeah, it's vague enough.
You know, like, happen. Yeah.
I'm
thinking more in line with, you know, log analysis, audit trail analysis, just piecing together the general picture of, you know, flow logs and various other things into a single new forensics dashboard or forensics product for.
So something more analogous to guard duty.
After the fact analysis of events.
Okay. Matt, your third and final pick.
I don't like any of my two remaining ones, so I'm going to make one up on the fly. GCP is going to make fun of Azure for backing Redis in a subtle way.
I would say that's more of an Amazon thing, but yeah, okay. I'll let you take this 0 point.
I literally made it up as I was saying it.
Perfect. So Amazon's more petty. Don't know about GCP. I haven't seen it. I would love to see GCP be a little bit pettier. That'd be kind of awesome. So I'm hoping for it just from that fact alone, because that'd be fun to talk about.
But I remember when like Anthos kind of came out and they were saying that you could run, you know, GKE anywhere. And, you know, they said anywhere, and then they showed like Amazon EC2 IP addresses.
Yeah, they showed the EC2 console. Yeah.
That's kind of where I'm like thinking like they'll be petty, like kind of petty in that way.
Okay. All right. I still think that GCP will sign a partnership with Redis and support Valky, because that's the GCP way. All right, Ryan, yeah. Your third and final.
GCP will announce basically announce an AI robot or an AI enhancement to their HomePod thing.
To their Google Assistant?
That's it.
See, after you did that NFS test one, I was sort of like, oh, Google should announce a managed SFTP solution. It would be really great. And I thought maybe you were going to go there, but you didn't. But if we could get an SFTP solution, we'd be really happy.
It's just not where my problems lie.
I understand.
Unfortunately. Yeah.
All right. Well, in honor of this, because Ryan and Jonathan or I or Matt even could all tie with 0 points, we need to have a tiebreaker. And so, again, Price is Right rules here. We're going with two tiebreakers because we thought it'd be fun to do two, because we did this one last time and I complained about it, which they all wanted this one, of course. And then the normal one, which is main stage announcements. So the first one is, how many times will they say AI or LLM on stage?
Or large language model in full text?
I will give it full text, LLM, okay. Or AI.
All right.
Trying to remember my just ridiculous level of guessing for reInvent.
And because this is the draft, it's reverse order. So Ryan gets to give us his number first.
Mm-hmm. Just the one keynote from Thomas Kurian on Tuesday morning.
Just the, right? Thomas Kurian keynote. They do technically have a developer keynote on Wednesday, but it is not as big of a deal as the Thomas Kurian one is. It's not like Amazon where they have three big keynotes.
Yeah, it's more of like an indoctrination keynote. Join us.
It's the Kool-Aid keynote, yeah.
Kubernetes, join us.
BigQuery. BigQuery and Kubernetes will solve all.
I'm going to say 67.
All right. Ooh. Nice number. Matt, you get second choice.
All right. So I cheated. I looked back at the AWS, it's 204.
Mm-hmm. It was a lot.
So based on that.
Before you give that number, remember.
There's extra keynotes too.
Yeah, that was across all three keynotes, not just one. Mm-hmm. So again, I just put that out there.
142.
All right. And Jonathan.
52.
Now, I could be a bad person and go 143.
Or you could go 53.
But I feel pretty good about 78. So I'm going to go there. It'll be interesting. I suspect it's going to be a number that we're all going to be shocked about. So that'll be fun. Mm-hmm. All right. So then the final, more predictable one that we always do is, how many main stage announcements will be on stage during Thomas Kurian's keynote? And Matt, I chose you for the first one because I just picked a random order for the last one because we already use reverse draft.
Since you're not going to win the other one, then we have a chance this one. Yeah.
Since you're barely none of these. Maybe what, 25.
25. Jonathan?
Nine.
Okay. I will go with one. Ryan.
Nah, that's what I was going to do. One big one. Yeah. Fine. Two.
Thanks, Ryan. I didn't do it to you earlier, but thanks.
He's like, Slackbot reminder for next time.
Just screw be Ryan petty. Over. Screw Ryan. It's noted. All right. Well, let's wrap up the show because we're already an hour in and we've got still a little bit more to go. So up next is Azure. Azure is announcing new tools for AI quality and safety challenges. They are available now or coming soon to Azure AI Studio for generative AI app developers. The new features are Prompt Shield to detect and block prompt injection attacks, including a new model for identifying indirect prompt attacks before they impact your model, coming soon and now available, which was weird because how is it both coming soon and available? And that made no sense, so I had to go do more research. And so the Prompt Shield for jailbreak attacks is in preview. The Prompt Shield for indirect attacks, that is coming soon. Groundedness detection to detect hallucinations and model outputs is coming soon. Safety systems to measure to steer your model's behavior towards safe, responsible outputs is coming soon. Safety evaluations to assess an application's vulnerability to jailbreak attacks and generate content risks, now available in preview. And risk and safety monitoring to understand what model inputs, outputs, end users, and trigger content filters to inform mitigations, coming soon and now available in preview in Azure OpenAI Service.
I mean, way to like rush the announcement out. Like it's
everything's coming soon, but you had to get it out there because you were like, Google Next is coming. Let's be up the press first. Yeah.
I mean, if this was AWS, it would be like seven announcements.
Seven. It'd be
coming soon
20.
Yesterday. You know, released today for each one of the services.
I do think we're going to see a lot more of these type of services or augments to the existing sort of AI studio products across the board, just because everyone's having the same thoughts of like, oh, we haven't put any protections or guardrails. What are we going to do? We put all our data in this custom model. Maybe that wasn't a good idea.
Maybe we should. Yeah. And especially since you're adding stuff to like your web page and, you know, core aspects of the product, you're giving it full access to your database. Like, you're going to want some levels of protection in there. Yeah. The whole Azure OpenAI Studio is like a completely different interface in the Azure console. It's like one of those pet peeves of mine. It's like every time I have to go to it, you know, I deploy with Terraform and everything else. But, you know, when I actually go like clicking in and stuff like that, I always am like, oh, wait, it opens a whole new console and it goes to this whole new thing and drives me a little bit crazy. So I'm like, I understand that you rush this out, you know, and get it out there, but like, can we slowly integrate it in and make it look normal? It just reminds me of like Macy V1 and, you know, a few of these other ones that were like not fully baked out, that just kind of were like, here we go. Oh, it's in here. We're ready.
Yeah. Every acquisition product day one, right? And then it's either completely rewritten or it'll stay like that for an eternity as this weird orphaned like other thing.
Yeah. Just a pet peeve of mine. Sorry, we digress as always.
Mm-hmm. No worries.
This is why people listen to us.
That's not good. All right. You can now use Microsoft's Azure Virtual Network Manager to enhance network security. Managing the scale of your network at large and diverse employers like Microsoft is incredibly difficult leveraging traditional models for network security. They point at the NSGs available in Azure like centralized, decentralized, and hybrid, and they all have strengths and weaknesses. Ideally, the best model is a hybrid model of network security where some are globally managed and some are locally managed. However, this further results in consistency, complexity, and lack of enforcement. To address these, they are building a new model based on Azure Virtual Network Manager, which allows the governance team to create and apply admin results across multiple NSGs while still enabling the app team to manage their own NSG rules. To do this, they introduced network groups, which is a collection of network resources that can be defined using logical conditions. And the fact they didn't use AI for all of this just shocks me.
There already is some AI where like it will, it's more ML, but like it does track and, you know, at the NSG level will recommend that you put blocks in place of things that don't need to be open, like 3389 and stuff like that, if they're not being used, like at the NSG level. So not at the global level.
Okay. That makes some sense to me, I guess.
I mean, the feature is really about, you know, having your sort of security guardrails and your compliance checks, but also like enabling developers to work and not be blocked by network.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You know, enforcement at every level. And so like, I think that this is these types of announcements are huge. GCP's had this for a little while.
AWS has it.
And yeah. And AWS sort of has it, right? Because you could do ACLs, which are a very big hammer, and then you could do security groups on top of that. But like,
so this is a struggle for me on Azure, which is like NSGs act as like this dual layer of ACLs and security groups. And it's always like a struggle for me because I want that more granular control that both give you, but NSG is kind of like fits both of them, and I haven't fully found where I land, if I like it, if I don't like it, kind of go down that route.
Yeah, I mean, this feature would make even more sense in that context where you're going to set like your denial public in your private dev environments, but then allow individual NSGs to be operated on by local dev teams. So, yeah, cool.
All right. And then Cloudflare is our last set of stories today. So they like to release new products on April Fool's Day. This also happens to be their week of development, which they have 5 days of announcements for their developers. Cloudflare is kind of an interesting company for what they're doing. They're doing a lot of cool edge things. If you're trying to build cloud native apps, Cloudflare is probably a pretty good place to check out. But if you have any traditional legacy things, they're not going to help you out so much.
Nope.
But the three things they're announcing on April Fool's this year was, and these are not April Fool's jokes, these are real features. D1, their serverless SQL database. Hyperdrive, which makes your existing database feel like it's distributed. And Worker Analytics Engine, their new time series database. So first up, D1 is a core database, is one of your most critical pieces of infrastructures, needing to be ultra reliable. It can't lose data. It needs to scale. And so Cloudflare has set out to build D1, their global serverless databases. It supports 10 gig databases and 50,000 databases per account, new data export capabilities, and enhanced query debugging via D1 Insights. The free tier, you get 25 billion reads per month, 50 million writes in a month, and 5 gigs of storage included. They have a lot planned for D1, including global read replication, even larger databases, and more time travel capabilities to allow you to branch your database and use new APIs for dynamic querying and or create a new database on the fly from within a worker. Seems pretty cool to me on the surface, but this does not talk MySQL, does not talk Postgres, does not talk anything that you would typically use for database. And so, yes, you can definitely build to this, but you will be locked into Cloudflare for sure.
But it's serverless.
Oh, you're not going down the vendor lock-in path. Oh. I would like to think that you could build abstractions and make it not quite so vendor locked in, but 50,000 databases per account is a big number. I kind of wonder if they're sort of catering to, you know, the EU or some other place whereby you may want to have a separate database per tenant, so it's easier to handle you know, destruction of a specific customer data. Yeah,
that was my takeaway on this, is that to have a 10 gig limit on database and 50,000 per account, like, this is to me is, oh, you're going to do tenant isolation at a schema level. And so, you know, and they'll eventually probably increase that to 20, 30, 100 gigs, whatever. But yeah, no, it felt very much to me like, oh, this is designed for a company who's trying to do high speed consumer base or SaaS based for enterprises with a dedicated tenancy. So that makes sense to me.
I mean, I like that tenancy model when I don't have to manage like noisy neighbor nonsense and performance differences at tiers. And as long as that's Cloudflare's problem, I'm into this.
Well, if you're a little bit more traditional, HyperDrive might be a better choice for you. This was launched in beta in September, but now generally available for Postgres. HyperDrive is designed to make the centralized database you already have feel like they are global. They use their global network to get faster routes to your database, keep connection pools primed, and cache your most frequently run queries as close to the user as possible. Importantly, HyperDrive supports the most popular drivers and ORM libraries out of the box, and so you don't have to relearn or rewrite your queries. Again, they're not done with this one. They're also going to support MySQL very soon, as well as support connecting to databases inside private networks, including other cloud VPCs, via the Cloudflare Tunnel and the Magic WAN. Cloudflare has decided they don't want to charge for it, and so you are already paying for the worker's paid plan. HyperDrive will be free for you.
Whoa. Yeah, I was going to say, like, it's a bold move offering this, like, within my VPC, you know, managed service for Postgres. Okay. Free?
Well, with a worker paid plan. So you have to have workers that are using this capability. So you,
sure,
you don't get benefit from other clients using this platform.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is what AWS could have done with the RDS proxy, actually, because they had a proxy which was designed to route to a DR region or another region in case the local region failed. They could equally have built caching for queries into something like that. So,
which I thought they were going to do, and then they never really delivered on that feature beyond announcing it.
Yeah,
and they're now decommissioning the serverless Aurora versions too. So it's like, what are they doing?
Yeah, there's even less need for them to do it now, because that's part of the reason why you wanted that layer, was to keep the Aurora serverless primed, so you weren't getting timeout. Oh no, wait, the proxy's going to hold the timeout long, and then we spin up the resource behind the hood. So.
Well, RDS proxy was, I thought, more for like Lambdas and other things that, you know.
It was designed mostly for Lambda because of the connection pool exhaustion that you get for Lambda. But you could use it for other things too. That was the nice part about it. It could help you in other use cases.
Yeah, I used it with like hundreds of EC2 instances, even two, just to connection pool in different ways, like with Lambdas.
Yeah. And then the third one is the Worker Analytics Engine, providing unlimited cardinality analytics at scale via built-in API to write data points from workers and a SQL API to query the data itself. Worker Analytics Engine is powered by the same ClickHouse-based systems that they have depended on for years at Cloudflare. And since launching in beta, developers have depended on Worker Analytics for many use cases, from large enterprises to open source projects such as Counterscale. Workers free and workers paid will include an allocation of data points, written and read queries, and you pay for both the written and read queries based on the analytics need you have. So that one get a little bit pricey, but that's the way all analytics products are. So do the math.
Coming soon at the next announcement, they will announce limits on the cardinality of the a whole bunch of mid-market enterprises are like, hold my beer.
Exactly.
I didn't see pricing on that, but I know, what do I miss and have? Custom metrics in CloudWatch, like 50 cents each a month. So I imagine it's similar pricing because the...
So the analytics engine is priced for workers. So there's workers pay and there's worker free tier. So the worker free tier gives you 100,000 data points written per day and 10,000 reads per day. And the workers paid gives you 10 million included per month, plus an additional 25 cents per additional million for written. And then raids are 1 million included per month, plus a dollar per additional million read queries. Hmm. So it could get pricey.
Pricey if you use it.
Yeah.
For reading back. It's yeah. Great for gathering audit trails and things, but mm-hmm. you know, expensive to actually consume and use it for nothing.
Exactly.
Yeah. But, you know, yeah, it's not like log data, right? It's not got content. It's just, it's metric dimensions. And so yeah. like they have value at a larger time scale, but you know, how long have we been sort of grouping them together? The older they get in time and losing the sort of granularity.
Yeah. I guess it's the kind of thing that you don't have to have this running on every single worker either. You have it running on 10% of workers or some, you know, some representative sample. So you don't need to collect metrics for everything all the time.
Mm, yeah.
I hadn't thought of that.
That makes sense.
Yeah. That was always a concept that I felt like I wanted more people to do with like Datadog and New Relic, which was, you know, besides just baking into your image or, you know, into anything else, like put it on a sample set and then launch, you know, either two things or, you know, hey, put a tag on a box and on boot up, it would like read the tag or something along those lines, you know, which obviously New Relic and Datadog doesn't want you to do because they want you to get all the data, but, you know, get it from a sample size and from there you can extrapolate whatever the problem is.
Yeah, I think statistically, once you're in production and once you look fairly stable, you can start backing that sampling size down to save money. And then, you know, if it looks like you're having problems, then you increase the sampling size, as long as the sample size is like statistically significant.
But it's a hard argument to have with people, you know, as you start to work through it, because they're like, well, what if the issue isn't on that one node or et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, aren't most of the issues like configuration based though? Like in my experience, it's either a failure that's not well designed around, like where you've got isolation, or it's like we screwed up and didn't push the code to that one thing, and that's where we're getting the issues. And so like I think that you would lose the ability to detect some of these things if you had done that. But
yeah.
I do like the idea of how to use it, how to save money. Just
For me, it was always a money savings concept mm-hmm. of you don't need it everywhere. If I run 100, you know, web servers, why do I need the same CPU metric from all 100? You know,
I mean, like
can I put it on 10?
But you know, some companies mm-hmm. like
Honeycomb,
yeah, they basically say, you know, actually that's wrong because your one web server that's performing, you know, 25% slower for your web application is causing, you know, every user who uses that server to have a bad experience. So you don't want to lose that metric telemetry either. So there's arguments both ways on those things, but. If you need high cardinality monitoring, you know, you need a solution that can support it. If you don't, then yeah, like using sampling is a way to go.
Yes.
I mean, I think it kind of comes down to the difference between observability and logging.
True.
Sure, if you're logging, log everything. If you care about observability, then just general trends are enough to give you a picture.
That's funny. I actually go the other way on that. Like almost directly where it's like I want all the metrics, but how much of those logs are useful? Well, very little, right?
And so the best solution I ever saw was someone had come up with an idea, I think for Lambda, and it was basically, you know, if you had it hit an error condition in your log, right, it would basically capture the 25 log entries before and the 25 log entries after, and that's all it would send. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that's kind of brilliant, because the reality is I don't care about the thousands of transactions that happened that were successful. I only care when something went bump in the night, and if mm-hmm. you give me, you know, basically what events that preceded and postceded the event, then I can get a pretty good picture without having to take all the log ingestion. So there's definitely something to be said about logging. You don't necessarily need everything, but it depends on your setup.
Yeah, it depends on...
Or security auditing, then you need everything because security wants it all.
Right. I was going to say, depending on your compliance or regulations, you know, but...
Yeah. They want it all, but they have no budget to pay for it. So good luck.
Or ability to process it.
Yeah, it's the processing. Here's all the logs. Somebody tell me how you're processing that because I would love to understand.
Yeah.
See you later, guys.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.
See ya. And that's the Week in Cloud. We'd like to thank this week's sponsor, Sunry. Check out a 14-day free trial at sunry.co/cloudpod. Check out our website, the home of the CloudPod, where you can check out our newsletter, Slack team, send feedback, or ask questions at thecloudpod.net, or tweet at us with hashtag #PoundTheCloudPod. All right. I have a story for you guys, which I think is interesting because it raises a bunch of questions for me. So basically, I stumbled across this article last week. We didn't have time to talk about it last week on the show, but it was from Indie TV World. And basically, the headline is Biggest Deepfake Fraud, Fake Zoom Meeting, CFO Cloned, and $25 Million Stolen. And so I was intrigued by this article, of course, so I had to read about it. So basically, a Hong Kong finance employee was a victim to a $26.5 million scam that leveraged multiple deepfake capabilities. The perpetrators used deepfake technology to transform publicly available video and audio footage into lifelike versions of the company's staff members, including a digitally cloned chief financial officer. The victim, a finance department employee, received a phishing email in mid-January, preferably from the company's UK-based CFO, instructing them to conduct a secret transaction. Despite the initial moment of doubt, the employee succumbed to the ruse after participating in a group video conference, and during the call, the deepfake representations of company employees appeared authentic, leading the victim to follow the instructions and make 15 transfers totaling $25 million to five different banks. This episode took over 1 week from the initial contact to the point the victim realized the scam, and the scammers digitally recreated the meeting's participants using deepfake technology, imitating their voices and appearances with convincing accuracy. Scammers employed a scripted self-introduction and gave orders before abruptly ending the meeting. Following the initial contact, scammers continued to engage with the victim through IM, emails, and one-on-one video calls.
I mean, how do you get mad at the employee? Like, sure, you got caught in phishing, but like,
yeah,
that's an intense level of phishing.
And that was kind of my thing about it, is like, as a security professional, you know, which I don't own security, but I participate quite heavily with our security team, so I feel security adjacent. I'm like, okay, so how do you create a scenario for this where you teach them, like, you know, you need to think if someone's calling you to get a wire transfer, like you need to have a secret code word that you guys have pre-shared, or, you know, like all kinds of different things you need to do. And the other part of this, I think, is interesting too, is that a lot of corporate bank accounts don't have the ability to do like a dual authorization for a wire transfer. So if you don't have some capabilities in your corporate bank, like, there's so many opportunities for this to be abused. And how do you even train on this? Like, yeah, I'm not mad at the guy. Like, mm-hmm. poor fella. I mean, like, he was a little suspicious, but if I got on a video call and the CFO was talking to me and they were following up with me on IAM and it looked legit to me, I don't know that I would have questioned it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I don't know. I mean, how many times does a CFO ask you to make random payments to random bank accounts that aren't already, you know, established vendors or creditors or something else?
Well, I mean, if you're like, hey, doing a secret acquisition of this company, you know, like, I don't know.
I'd like more context around the whole thing. And, you know,
I mean, there's definitely a red flag.
There are red flags here for sure.
Let's not say that they're what words, but that's a pretty impressive, you know, this goes back to the same thing we talked about during the show, which is like, you know, they added stuff from 2021, you know, three, four years ago, which really just makes me feel like the time really flies, you know, into everything, you know. And here, this is a multi-pronged attack that, you know, included somebody sitting down and deep faking the CFO and multiple other people doing one-on-one meetings that, you know, live, you know, chat with somebody and tell them what to do. Like, that's a impressive feat.
I'm going to be entirely too cynical now and say I know the technology's around that could put all this together piece by piece. The dates they would have needed for the voice cloning to make it genuine is probably not something that was publicly available. I would not be surprised if it.
You're forgetting how much theater they put into this, right? Come on, you scripted environment. They abruptly ended the call, right? So they're intentionally condensing the venue. And they're in control of the narrative because it's like this emergency last minute thing where they're probably not allowing a whole lot of interaction. So
I'm gonna stick my neck out.
Yeah.
And say I would not be surprised if the employee who was the victim was actually in on the ruse.
Maybe. I don't know.
Victim blaming. Jonathan, why are you victim blaming?
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, all right.
Yeah. I do like the idea, though, that, you know, we should bring back secret handshakes, because I think that's the only way we're really going to be able to protect ourselves against, you know, being deepfaked. On the plus side, everything that Justin asked me to do right now, I'm just going to assume is a deep fake. So I'm not going to do any of it.
It's a good strategy. It's a good way to get eventually fired, I suppose.
He has to listen to you that he's fired first. He just keeps showing up. Well, we stop paying him, but he still shows up. So whatever.
I'm not saying I won't do anything. I'm just going to do what I want.
Well,
it's when the first telephone scams and the robocaller scams things came out last year with voice cloning, and hear stories about parents being called up with voice clones of their kids asking for money for an emergency and things. I arranged with my family that we would have a secret word, which we wouldn't share with anybody. And if there was a weird request that came for something that seemed unusual, if there's anything off about it, then what's the password? No password, no money. But I guess in an emergency, I suppose there's always the consideration that somebody can't remember what that was, so it has to be something memorable and unlikely to be forgotten in the moment.
I mean, I grew up in the 80s, of course, so my mother, I think, was scarred pretty hard by the Oprah kidnapping episode, where they showed how easy it was to kidnap children, and so she ingrained into my head, like, if I ever send anybody who isn't your mom or dad or someone you know in the family, I'll always give them this code word. And so I know that code word in the back of my head, like, they have to have that or else the stranger danger. So I do know the code word thing a little bit. But yeah.
In my ADHD, like, madhouse that I live, like, I'm trying to remember, like, if I'm trying to figure out, like, of all the family members, which one of us could actually remember a code word for longer than 15 minutes. And I'm like, maybe my wife. The rest of us are hosed.
Well, that's the code right there. Then you're like, how the hell should I remember? That's the code.
Hell if I know. You got it right.
Hey, nailed it.
I mean, since we're in the after show here, I had to also point out Jonathan's awesome shirt that says, "Of course I talk to myself. Sometimes I need expert advice."
Yeah.
I watched it through the whole recording. I was like, that is a good shirt. I want this shirt.
It is.
All right, guys. We'll talk to you after Google Next. We'll be recording late. Woo! after next week. So, let's talk about that.
See you later.
Later.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.